This is Gaten the Mecha, the weekly anime and manga show where we take things one step further. I analyze everything from arcs to OPs to episodes in my wacky but enjoyable quest to make sense of all of it. Welcome back to Gaten the Mecha. I'm your host Jamal today, and in this episode, I am giving you a very late and overdue look at My Hero Academia Heroes Rising. Hopefully you guys are staying safe and staying at home as necessary, and I've been doing the same. And the thing about that is that we have a lot of free time to kind of think and bathe in our own minds, and as a result I've had enough time to bathe in my own mind and think about Heroes Rising because I couldn't think of anything to record this week. So that's what we'll be looking at today. I'll be looking into the antagonism which makes up most of the film. We'll be looking at some Sakuga, which I'm really excited about, a specific sequence as well, and a few more things about the film and my feelings towards it. Quickly, before we start today's episode, I have a small but, well, I think small, but also quite nice thing to announce, and that has been that on feedspot.com, our podcast has been noted to be one of the top 30 manga podcasts on the web, so that's quite nice. I don't really know truly what that means, but either way, I'm very happy, and I guess I can only thank you guys for being there and supporting the show through listening and reviewing, etc. And on the note of reviewing, if you do enjoy the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you do get your podcasts if they have reviews. Helps me understand what I'm doing right and wrong, and also just shares the show as well, and loads of people can find out about it. And that's how things like that happen. So that's really it for the intro. If you haven't already, and I know you're probably at home, go to the castle and make some coffee or something, get a snack, as this is going to be an interesting review. So here's the episode for this week. This is episode 38 of Gaten the Mecha, an overdue Heroes Rising review. My approach to this episode, really, when I did write it and when I did think about it, was to just approach it as an overview of the film and maybe dissect a few main parts of it. But I'm not going to be going into plot details and things and how the film ends and all of that. Just more of a general review with some foci or focus areas. I know a lot of people, or there's still many people across the world who haven't seen the film because it maybe didn't air in cinemas, and you may have seen it through other means, but on the most part I'm depending on that, and therefore I'm not going to be talking in detail about those plot points anyway. I'm also not going to be doing a plot summary because, again, that kind of contributes to the spoilery aspect, but I'll be talking about the basic premise of the film, and then I'll be going into my short and really concise basic review, and then my longer form review after that shorter one. However, they may be spoilers for the series so far, so when I did write this, this was just about between the overhaul arc and the cultural festival arc, or I know most of the film takes place between then, so everything up to the Shihasuke arc, or everything before the cultural festival arc, so after Chisaki versus Deku, everything between that will be potentially used as reference within this episode to evidence what I'm trying to say. And so without further ado, let's go into a very impromptu and scuffed version of the plot summary. So essentially the film is about, as the title implies, Heroes Rising. It is about our young heroes, or to-be heroes at UA Academy, learning to use their own devices and become almost independent as developing heroes. And they do this on an island. Again, so as the first movie went, on an island, we have another island formula going on, and essentially what they do is that they fight these guys who come and invade the island, the main person behind this being Nine, and Nine is sent there through Shigaraki, so it kind of links into the plot, and as a result there's a big battle, and that is the film essentially. It's the heroes learning to be heroes against an antagonist who appears when they're trying to become independent. And therefore that test of independence is the antagonist, the main one being Nine. And with that being said, let me get to the short answer. What do I, in very basic terms, think of this film? Sadly, I'm going to say it's decent at most. I'm not going to sugarcoat how I feel about it because that would be dishonest. And also I wanted to like this film, and it wasn't a bad film. I don't hate it, I don't dislike it, but I can't say that it's a great film. And the reason for that is because the nature of this antagonist-protagonist relationship is very weak on one side, and it's very weak on the antagonistic side. When we consider the nature of My Hero Academia and its antagonists, each antagonist you can mostly remember for them being standouts within their respective seasons or series or arcs because of their thought process and who they are, and their ambitions and philosophies are very different from each other. If we compare the likes of Chisaki to Shigaraki, or if we compare Shigaraki to Stain, there are evident and polarizing differences, and that's what makes them very independent, and that's why we remember them as villains of My Hero Academia or antagonists of My Hero Academia. Nine, however, is kind of this weird thematic blend between a lot of the villains which have already been part of My Hero, and it's not bad to share parts of one's ideology or philosophy, but when it becomes one of which doesn't really feel very unique, and even though it isn't completely unique to a certain extent, and that isn't to say that there aren't arguments for that being a good thing, the way of which the antagonism is inserted into the narrative feels very artificial, and it feels lopsided, as if there's something missing. And as a result, Nine feels almost like a placeholder, and as if anybody can be Nine. That relationship between the antagonist and the protagonist, and the basis of this film being about gaining independence, is weakened by the fact that if you don't have an antagonist that puts up a major challenge, not only just physically, but like almost philosophically and ideologically, a lot of that thematic weight is lost, and therefore I think it just brings down the entire film in general. One can't really be seen to be gaining so much independence and becoming a greater person when the roadblock in front of you wasn't that much of a roadblock. And again, I don't really mean physically, I'm not talking about, oh, he was weak, but if we're talking as a written character, I think he was weak because the ideology that's attached to him feels rather lackluster. That isn't to say that there aren't positives to this film. My Hero always manages to get stuff like character management right and screen time very well put together, to the extent where I'm feeling fulfilled with the amount of character screen time I'm getting for each character, as it's a large cast. That is done very well, and it's done appropriately from a technical perspective, and its production values, those are always top notch, and I'm very happy with how that turned out. But it was just that one element which ruined it for me, and that is why I don't feel like the film managed to meet my personal expectations. That is the short answer. That is my very short version of why I didn't necessarily think the film was amazing. However, there is a lot more to this argument. So if you are to leave the podcast now and just turn off and say, screw it, I'm going back to quarantine, Jamal hates this film, then sure, do that. However, just know that you are missing out on a lot of nuance to the argument. And that is not it in full form. That is it essentially in 5 minutes. So if we are to get to my longer look at this film, I think the first thing to establish is that I can most definitely see the appeal for this film. I can understand why someone would say this is a good film, and I can agree with them in some areas. I think the premise is also fine, and it's really funny how they seem to have a formula going. It's on an island, just like last time, not necessarily the biggest access to heroes. An antagonist comes out of the midst, and they have to battle, obviously, to solve this dispute. It's a very simple formula, but it's also quite effective and really easy to set up. I wouldn't be surprised if Horikoshi makes it a sort of meme where every film ends up being on a different island, and I'm sure that there would somehow be a One Piece joke in there. Just an idea. But as I was saying, I think the film is fine, or the premise is fine, but I just think that there are problems in how it manages to go about using that premise to its biggest advantage, or its maximum advantage. I'm fine with a lot of, or most of, the framework of which this film runs, so how it almost comes about. So if we take the beginning and how it's explained, Shigaraki is responsible for Nine's appearance in the film. That is very fair. One of the main antagonists of the entire franchise is responsible for this assault upon this village. Again, very fair, and I can respect that completely. However, it's those values that Nine has and this villain has which brings down the quality of this film, I think. There is a counter-argument to this, and I will get to that a bit later, but I think that we can potentially say that Nine, although not necessarily being the greatest of antagonists in my opinion, still works very well for the franchise as a whole when we look at it from a holistic view because of how it exemplifies the nature of Shigaraki as a character, and it repeats or exacerbates this behavior which he seems to be having both across fourth season and now. I know I seem to be saying a lot about Nine's philosophy, but what exactly is Nine's philosophy? And I'll go into that now. And this is probably the most spoilery I will get. However, I'm going to be basically scraping the surface, mostly because I kind of feel like this ideology in itself is rather surface level. Nine, in summary, believes in utopianism. He believes that he can create this almost utopia or ideal world for himself within his own image. And as a result, he can, from the ground up almost, or by tearing down this island or whatever, create this new form of meritocracy, this new system. The strong will rule on top, essentially. So therefore, those who... So similarly to Chusaki, who rejects the natural order, he rejects that natural notion of hierarchy. Nine simply believes in strength being on top, similarly to Chusaki, however he doesn't really comment on the natural order. This by itself sounds okay, and I'm not expecting in the space of 1 hour 30 minutes to create Griffith. I'm not expecting Canute from Vinland Saga. I'm not expecting that level of utopianism. I can understand that there are restraints and time limits, and the amount of which you can build upon this character is very limited. However, I think there are two things. I think one, which has actually just popped into my head, is that MHA has shown that it has the potential to do that. And that kind of disappoints me in how, within the space of almost an episode, I feel like I understood Chusaki so much more, with the likes of the final episode of the Shihasaki arc, how he refers to them as hero pretenders and destroying the natural order, and all these other words which he said almost within one episode in itself. That felt quite powerful. When we take the space of 1 hour 30 minutes, and we're briefly given about a flashback about wanting to defeat those who wrongs them and called them villains because they apparently don't like that term, and then just add that to the words of Nine referring to the utopia and the strong will rule, that is all we really get, and that is only exacerbated or added onto by them having this random sense of duty to take over this island. And I don't really think random is the term, but it feels very spontaneous and almost nonsensical. In my overhaul arc or Shihasaki arc episode, I honestly can't remember the number, but quite a while ago when we did speak about this arc, I referred to how, or I made reference to this notion of the mustache villain. The almost as basic villain as you can get, the drive to destroy is innate within them. The reason why they want to isn't really said. The resources and means to do so is to their disposal, and therefore they just do it because they can. The ideological villain, however, is also kind of an archetype at this point, and it's become almost naturalized within film and TV. A motive behind doing the destroying, because the audience has almost figured out that they don't like this. They don't like this extreme detachment from realism. They want something which feels a bit more justified, as opposed to something which feels almost arbitrary, which is, I want to kill because I want to kill. I want to destroy the world because I want to. And I'm not saying Nine is the mustache villain. However, it's very dangerous when you're mixing between the two, or at least you're in the gray area between the two. I would rather have an antagonist which is one or the other, in one or two of the states, because of the fact that when you get into the middle, it feels as if you're adding an ideology for the sake of adding one in, and in artificially imposing one into the narrative, because it has to be there for the sake of an audience, as opposed to having a naturalized villain or naturalized antagonist, although I also don't like that as well, but what I'm trying to say is that I feel like it's a lot worse when you have a much weaker ideology attached to a character whose ideology in written terms is quite grand, creating a utopia is quite grand, but when it's only a half measure and it's only just, I want to create a utopia because, And then there's not really much to say after that. It's just because they called us villains and we don't like that. Utopia it is. That doesn't feel very convincing to me. And that realism which we ask for within our ideological villains is lacking there. And no, when I say realism also, because I can feel someone telling me this. When I say realism, I don't mean a battle shonen anime needs to be realistic. However, motivation in itself, or motivations, although some people do say motivation's a myth, which I don't believe, motivations are realistic in themselves. It's a driving force behind our nature, you can argue. And so that implementing things which inspire our nature is quite essential, I think, for creating a character. If a character is made to emulate human life almost, or a level or degree of human life. And so I just don't feel like it's very convincing to have an ideological component that doesn't feel very convincing. And as I said before, it's simply an attachment because it needs to be there. And that's how it felt when I was watching 9 throughout the film. When I saw some sort of backstory behind it, I was like, okay, this is maybe getting a level or a degree more substantial than I once thought, but it kind of just ended there. And he kind of just got mad about the utopia and that was it. And then we win. The degree to which that was explored, I think, sadly, was quite poor. And when you consider the president of My Hero and how it's been able to build these ideologies within its antagonists in ways which are a lot more subtle, but actually quite effective. Stain in second season is a really good example of this. And that's even done again with the likes of Chisaki. All For One, I would potentially push back on, but I feel as if that is made for the enigma of his character, because we don't really know what that end game really is, or it's quite cloudy. It seems like he just wants to obtain power because it feels amazing, but I think that maybe adds to his enigma, or at least the mystery of All For One. And then Chisaki. I think Chisaki has probably been, I want to say the greatest, but I can't really confirm that. But I think ideologically it makes the most sense and is the most convincing. But being able to create those convincing ideologies has been done throughout the show in very minimal time. And so I find it quite a shame that that couldn't really be achieved in the likes of Heroes Rising. However, I am going to counter my argument for the sake of fairness, and I think it's just a good thing to do on the podcast, not to just bathe in my own opinions and believe they're completely correct. And so I have formed a tiny counter argument to what I've said, and that is how 9 has a greater role beyond this film and thematically, and instead he only exemplifies what we know about Tomura and his almost pattern of behavior. If we look at the conclusion to the Shihasaki arc, I would say that there's a fundamental and very important parallel which we can strike with that, as well as the conclusion or the near conclusion of the film. As a result, I would say that this creates almost a grand narrative. We're learning what he's doing and how he's trying to almost connive with the villain world for his own advantage. And he's becoming almost, if you want to be really meta about it, the villain of the villain world. He's attempting to make it his dog almost. I'm not going to say the alternative to that phrase. He's putting it on a leash and he's controlling it the way he wants to. And as a result, I think that is a crucial development. And I kind of abstain from using the term development because I think the term character development is thrown around quite a lot, usually without a lot of meaning. But I think it's a crucial element. Similarly to criminals and when they're being hunted, we have to determine or understand a modus operandi, or if I said it right, a modus operandi, or a mode of behavior, a mode of reasoning for a character or that person in general. We're doing the exact same thing with Tomura or Shigaraki in this case. And as a result, this kind of, it's a really good way of one, just implementing Shigaraki within to the narrative regardless of whether this is a film primarily about him or not. But also it just reinforces his importance to this narrative and the strength of which he has to bring down villains and antagonists which we thought were mighty for their time within the show. Chisaki is a good example of that. For 12 episodes or so, Chisaki was the kingpin almost for a while. He was the one who was dominating our attention and he was the one stirring things up. He was the one stirring things up, and when we get to Shigaraki, he kind of takes that over again. He's asserting dominance back into the narrative. He's controlling it and influencing it, and that I think is a good demonstration from Horikoshi as to the power of this character, whether it's on a non-canon basis or not. I think even though this film isn't necessarily truly canon per se, you can argue, and I potentially even argued for it to be semi-canon. You can even see some parallels to the canon, so some very similar cinematography or at least imagery of the events of fourth and third season. Even Nine, again, ideologically has some very big parallels with Chisaki. Nine as a character is kind of determined by some of the events of the fourth season, and as a result, we could say that these are almost thematically linked. Even similarities, again, physical similarities to All For One are also kind of a part of Nine's character. And so I could argue, or we could argue, that this is meant to be almost a thematic blend of the third and fourth season, and then just shows that Shigaraki still has control over all of it. It also would render my criticism relatively unfair or a bit less useful, as if it is a thematic blend, we can say that maybe that is an overall weakness of the show, potentially. An overall weakness of the show as this thematic blend maybe isn't so strong for the likes of My Hero Academia, since if we are to combine, again, in theory, All For One and Chisaki, it doesn't really mix very well, and I don't necessarily agree with that point per se, but it's just something to throw out there. I think just the main thing, if you are just fast-forwarding through this episode, or maybe just a bit confused as to what I said, because I phrase things very weirdly, as you can probably already tell, you've been here probably a long time already. But in summary, what I'm just trying to say is that I feel as if the antagonist-protagonist relationship is very one-sided, and the antagonist simply doesn't pull its weight for the film, which is a fundamental element of My Hero Academia. And with that not being pulled, I feel as if it brings down the film in general, because when we consider heroes rising as a concept, and I'm not gonna hold it too close to it, but when we consider heroes rising as a concept, it's an attempt to make these heroes, or to be heroes, more independent and evolving into heroes of their own, as opposed to students or heroes which are just being babied by the bigger heroes. I think part of gaining that independence and truly rising as heroes is being able to overcome a roadblock in thinking and ideology, as opposed to simply just a physical roadblock. The mental challenge is just as hard and taxing, as we've shown throughout the series. The mental challenge is almost just as strong, or potentially even stronger, than the physical roadblocks which come in the way of heroes, and we see it throughout the series, from season 1 to 4. I think season 2 is a really good example of that, when we get Ida and Stain, and the emotional impact of what happened to his brother is almost just as taxing on him as opposed to Stain being a strong antagonist. Having to overcome and sacrifice your anger for the sake of what we can argue to be justice is an essential part of becoming a hero within My Hero Academia's logic, and I don't feel like that is met very well, and so I feel like it contradicts that formula quite a bit. That is not to say that there are not good things about this film, and I'm not going to leave this on a bad note. I want to end on a high, because I think that although that did very much disappoint me, and I really did want to like this film, honestly, I wasn't going in with the sake of, oh no, another My Hero Academia movie, I'm not gonna like this. It was 10 a.m. when I watched this film. I don't have time or the energy to actively hate on a film because I just want to. There were only 10 people in the cinema. Okay, sure, there were some people talking in the back, but that didn't affect me. I just don't need to think that I'm just not liking it for the sake of not liking it. But as I was saying, there are good things about this film. I think the film, and I said this in the short version of the review, but I think the film is very strong in its character management, as always. And you have to consider, this is a different format, or a sub-format almost. This is, if our format is anime, and the quote-unquote standard format of anime is TV series, our sub-format is a spin-off film, or a non-canon film. That has to be managed and controlled differently in regards to screen time, as if we are to feature most of the main cast, if not all of it, the way of which this has to be done. It definitely requires a level of skill, and I can see that. It's done to almost perfection. I can't complain about it. Every character does have an important and fundamental role in, okay, maybe not fundamental, but definitely an important role within the narrative as a whole, as it's a collaborative effort from the beginning. That class spirit, which comes out of the likes of academia, part of the title, is very important, and it's not forgotten. That spirit as a class and a collective body sails throughout the film. It's also done very smartly by dividing the characters into groups a lot of the time, as opposed to just solo entities. And so we get to see some combinations which we're not necessarily all so used to within the classes. We don't get to see, and we probably won't be able to see, all these different characters collaborate on a one-on-one basis. So splitting them into twos and threes makes it really interesting to see that combined dynamic. And that is also done quite smartly in how their powers are used in combination for the sake of combat, and also just helping out the island and those who live on the island. I guess combination in general is quite a theme within My Hero Academia, and more particularly Heroes Rising. I guess Nine has, I guess All For One as well as Nine have powers which relate to the likes of combination and combining things together. And so it's a nice addition to that thematic element in the series and franchise as a whole. And then I don't want to say that I said that for filler purposes, but the main thing I want to get to is the Sakuga of this film. And it mostly concerns the end, and it's definitely Yutaka Nakamura's sequence by the end of the film. This was the first thing I tweeted when I came out of the cinema. I just spoke about the Nakamura sequences. Obviously, we don't have cuts to reference because the film has not come out on Blu-ray or DVD, and there aren't many ways to access it besides that. And so I can only say for memory how this fight sort of panned out. It's the Izuku Bakugo battle versus Nine. I'm not really going to say the details behind it. There are some insane techniques which I use here. I think the main thing that I love about Yutaka Nakamura as an animator, and why he is one of my favorite animators ever, is probably because the way of which he animates and his use of smearing and all that, it almost takes us on the journey through his animating process or his animation process. It feels to a degree kind of messy, and by no means do I mean messy in a bad way. When I say messy, it feels drawn. It feels as if I didn't have enough time to complete these colors because they're so bold and blocky. And again, I sound like I'm criticizing. If someone's to take a soundbite of this, they would think I'm just criticizing Nakamura. I mean that in the best way possible. Seeing Nakamura do more work on Bakugo as opposed to just Izuku, which we see almost, I don't know if it's every season, but we've seen it for about almost three seasons in a row. And we're very used to how Nakamura handles Izuku. However, when we see him handle Bakugo, it's a very different situation. And as we've only seen it about once or twice, I think, throughout the franchise. And so Nakamura's use of smearing for portraying the explosions which come out of his hand just look phenomenal, honestly. It reminds me of a lot of the work he did on Concrete Revolution and Mob Psycho 100. We use that combination of purple and orange and yellow to create a really nice, raw, explosive look. And then also on how he works in Izuku, he handles it similarly to the likes of the conclusion to the overall arc. And one thing I've realized, I feel like Nakamura's trying new things with the likes of My Hero. And this is how I think, the Bones meeting went over the phone when they were speaking to Nakamura, at least when he was in the office. I feel like they called him up and they said, we're working on a new movie. It's the My Hero Academia Heroes Rising movie. He said, okay, I'm on it. And then the president, I honestly don't know who, I can't remember the director at the moment, but I'm on a roll here. And he's speaking to Nakamura on the phone. And then he says, I want you to work on the final fight cuts. And Nakamura's like, I got it. Yeah. What do you want? And the director was like, this is a non-canon film. And Nakamura just starts smiling slowly. And then he says, I want you to work on two characters, Bakugo and Izuku. And then Nakamura's smile just opens up more. And then finally, the animation director's like, this needs to be about 2 minutes long. And Nakamura's just freaking out on the floor in smiling at how crazy he can get. And we see that definitely throughout this entire sequence. Instead of using simply just punches and melee combat, the use of projectiles almost in the land is so glorious. He manages to animate a whole block and chunk of land at Nine, and it just looks insane. It's probably my favorite cut of the film. I also just spoke about his use of smearing. He doesn't really use many impact frames for Izuku. If I'm not wrong, I might actually be wrong. I need to relook at the cuts anyway. The smearing is crazy. He goes really over the top with it on Izuku as well, using that light green when he's running towards Nine in that almost trench of land. And then obviously he ends it with impact frames on Nine himself. As we can tell, Yutaka Nakamura is just becoming more and more versatile. And I don't say he wasn't versatile in the first place. However, he's just trying new things with this series. And every time he does try something new, it creates waves, honestly. I remember when people were discussing the overall arc or Shihasaki arc and how that scene was going to create waves in the shonen genre. I didn't really buy that, to be honest. But that was people on Twitter. And then I see this fight. And if that created waves, I think we're creating tsunamis, honestly, with that caliber of animation as is. The Sakuga throughout the film, regardless of just Nakamura, but just some of the sequences throughout anyway, there's also like a really good amount of character acting Sakuga which comes out of the film. Overall, it's just splendid and what you expect from My Hero Academia is almost a high level, or at least high production value-esque battle shonen. I didn't really know how to phrase that, but as a battle shonen with high production values, it's what you expect and it delivers, and I'm definitely impressed with what it was able to deliver. And so that is the analysis for this week. I'm going to jump right into Link the VA. We haven't done Link the VA in a long time, and I need to give you a Link the VA. So without further ado, here is the Link the VA segment for Heroes Rising. If you are new to the Gen the Mecha podcast, the Link the VA segment is very simple. What I do is I go into my anime list, go through the voice actors on My Hero Academia or whatever show we're looking at, find one of those roles, and look at all the other roles they play in the world of anime. So this week is a bit of a different week, mostly because of how there are two voice actors. Not two voice actors for Nine, but I'm going to be looking at two voice actors, one for the English dub version and one for the Japanese version. The sad thing is that the Japanese voice actor for Nine, Inoue Yoshio, only has two voice roles logged on MAL, and so I'm going to be looking at his other role, which is also quite interesting. And then I will be looking at Johnny Yong Bosch, who's a very popular voice actor that I've only heard of him today. Has voice acted many, many roles in the realm of English dubbed anime. Also, one quick thing which I spotted, and this is kind of ironic in how we were speaking about Nine, but Nine as, or listed on MAL, although I don't really buy it, is listed as a supporting character for My Hero Academia. That kind of, I don't think it confirms my criticism, I'm kind of just joking about it, but that's kind of funny when you consider how I was saying that he didn't really hold much thematic weight, and so having him as a supporting character makes a bit more sense for what I'm saying. Anyway, so Yoshio Inoue plays both Nine, and in Sword Art Online Ordinal Scale plays Eiji Noshizawa. I can't say that name, however, he's the main antagonist of Ordinal Scale. When we consider that this is probably one of the only voice roles he's played, as well as Nine in My Hero, I can honestly say that he has a lot of talent, and I can hear it. I haven't seen Sword Art Online Ordinal Scale, and if you have been listening, as you know, what I do is I just pause the podcast when I'm recording it, watch a clip or two, and then report back. And I can say from one clip alone that he knows what he's doing, and he's really good at portraying the panic within Eiji's voice. I don't really know the backstory behind Eiji, sadly. However, from what I understand of the voice in itself, he's really able to portray his fear, as well as sort of when he goes mad as well by the end of the fight between Kirito. That laugh as well, it sounds really stuck in his throat for a bit. And I really love those sort of bold performances where it's kind of subtle, because his voice isn't necessarily insanely warped as he's fighting Kirito, or it sounds crazy. It sounds very normal, as you expect for someone who's simply playing a game or is trapped within a game. But then that progressively becomes a lot worse, and I mean worse in the good sense. It becomes a lot worse and slightly more croaky. And so it's really nice to see someone getting further into the industry, and I'd love to hear him in many more, both movies and TV series, hopefully. And then we go into our second voice actor, and I'm only going to go into one role because I think I want to keep Link the VA slightly shorter these days. However, apparently Johnny Yong Bosch is not a name that is unknown, and if anything, he is very popular among Mao with 10,000 favorites, so that's a very big deal. He plays roles which I didn't even know he played, so I know, and the one I was going to talk about was Yukio from Ono Exorcist, but he also plays the main character of Durara, who is Isaiah Orihara. I'm not very savvy in regards to Durara. He also plays one of the main characters of Free, which is Makoto. He also plays Olga Ituka in the likes of the Gundam franchise, as well as Daryl Lorenz in the Gundam franchise. He plays Sasori in Naruto Shippuden. He plays Yagura in Naruto Shippuden. He plays Toji in Neon Genesis Evangelion. I'm assuming that's the new dub. I don't think it's the old one, but I'm not too sure, honestly. He plays Yusaka in Toradora. And then there's finally the one I can't forget, which is Ichigo from Bleach. Although I said all those roles, I'm just going to go on one, and that is going to be Yukio from Ono Exorcist, probably because it's the first anime, or probably the second anime I ever watched, as well as one of the first anime I watched in subtitles, I think. To be fair, the only anime I watched without subtitles was Naruto Shippuden up to about episode 400, and then it stopped being dubbed by the time of which I was watching it. And then I watched Ono Exorcist in full subtitles, so I have never heard this voice before. When it comes to Yukio, and I don't know if people are going to like this or not, but I don't really care. However, when it comes to dub in general, an inherent criticism of dub, and people just kind of throw it out all the time, it doesn't capture all the emotions of the characters. And so I can agree with that in some cases, but I think in this case, I disagree with that completely, especially when it comes to Ono Exorcist, and I've never heard this dub before, so this is literally my first time hearing it ever. And in this case, I don't want to say it's better per se, but when we consider that Yukio is supposed to be 15 years old, I feel like Yukio actually feels like he's 15 for a character that acts a lot older than he usually is a lot of the time. And actually hearing his voice this time makes me believe that he is a teenager. I honestly thought, when I didn't check the ages of the characters, I don't often check ages of characters anyway because it doesn't usually influence how I think of the show, but when I consider Yukio being 15, I never used to know that Yukio was 15 until like a few minutes ago. I knew he was a teenager, or supposed to be. I know they're in high school and all that, so I would have figured out he's a teenager. Yeah, Yukio is supposed to be in like year 10, or in American terms, I don't know, 10th grade. He doesn't really look that way, and he doesn't strike me like that. However, the dub is able to anchor that back, and so I really respect Mr. Bosch for being able to do that. And so that is the lengthy VA segment, quite a short one, but also I think we got a bit of value out of it. And I definitely learned about a new dub actor, which I never knew of. I don't usually search up dub voice actors, not because I don't like them or anything like that. I haven't watched a dubbed anime in a very long time. I've only literally seen about one or two, so I don't really have much experience with them. And so I'm learning about them almost each and every time we do these segments with dub voice actors. And so let's pivot to the In The Moment segment now to just quickly talk about a manga which I have been reading recently, and I might speak about something else as well. This week, you know, we've been at home for a very long time now. We're emerging the second week. School ended for me 2 weeks ago now, which feels like it was yesterday, basically. But things are getting long, and we're probably going to be here for longer. And so when you're stuck in quarantine, most people, you know, they would read, a lot of people would read the logical things. They would read the long series, which they never managed to do because they were too busy with school or homework or university or work. And so you'd probably read something like Bleach because it's coming back. You'd read something like Hunter x Hunter because, although it's not coming back, or I'm not going to say that because you never know, but it's quite long and you have a lot of time to read Hunter x Hunter. Might read Yu Yu Hakusho, might read Naruto for the first time, or if you want to be really bold, you can read One Piece because we don't know whether the world's going to end or not. So most people do that, but what do? I do this stupid thing and I sell my soul to read Redo of Healer. I don't know why I did this, but it's been a thing recently because Redo of Healer is getting an anime adaptation this year, I believe this year anyway. And people have been talking about how this is going to create a very big storm, similar to the likes of Interspecies Reviewers and the beginning of Shield Hero. It's going to create some controversy, or Goblin Slayer is a good example. It's going to rile up the anime community a bit. And so I just went head in and I wanted to see what this is about, because people have been saying this to me, not personally, but people have been saying this around Twitter and in some forums and stuff for months. And so I wanted to truly find out what this is all about, just in preparation. And they're not wrong. They are not wrong at all. Redo of Healer is basically what I'm going to call borderline H, semi-controversial. I don't want to say controversial is a weird word to use for an anime, I think, but semi-controversial borderline H twist on the isekai genre. And if you have been listening to earlier podcasts, I'll just say it now, I have been reading a few borderline H manga here and there, Nozoki Ana being the main one, probably my favorite. You can do the searching yourself. However, I've been reading a few of those, and I have now had an addition to my very shameful collection of them on my phone, and that is Redo of Healer. And although it does have that twist, it does kind of feel a bit good in some areas. And when I say good, I don't mean the Borderline H element. I mean, some of the things it does are a lot more thought out than a lot of the isekai which I understand or have watched before. And I'll come clean, I don't watch much isekai, I don't read much isekai, so my opinion might be a bit limited and might be even invalid. However, I think stuff, as a gamer or someone that plays games regularly, stuff like the resistance system and leveling system and skill system feel a lot more interesting and exciting, and it results in stuff like self-sacrifice in order to gain resistances. In order to gain a resistance from something, you have to go through it. Or it kind of reminds me of Diablo 2, although you don't have to do that directly, you have to just fight and kill things, then you can level up resistances or gain certain items. But that resistance system in general, I think, is a really good one, and it derives from doing things which you evoke a resistance from or develop a resistance from. In order to gain a poison resistance, you need to have consumed poison before. Stuff like that I think are very interesting, and also again, more of its leveling system, although it doesn't visualize, or what I've seen so far, it doesn't visualize a skill system or a skill tree similar to the likes of Shield Hero, reminds me a lot of Path of Exile. The skills are still a lot more profound and interesting. It's not just defense, attack, mana, it's stuff like escape skills, it's stuff like alchemy skills, and those are in some other isekai, but I think how it comes across, and even the different dimensions of heal, are really interesting, and in how the use of healing can be used so differently to what we know as just healing HP and healing mana. We can reverse heal, and we can simulate heal, and we can corrupt heal, and all these different elements of healing and combining skills together to create these almost, not glitches, but almost quote-unquote life hacks in the game for better results and level caps. That's probably the best part, the level cap system. Although how that is derived, I will leave you to do yourself. You can read the manga to find out, because the level cap system and how people are using it is a bit questionable. That's where the borderline age twist comes in. Would I say it's worth the read? If it piques your interest and you just want to know what I'm talking about, definitely read it, because it doesn't disappoint in that area. But if you're not used to this sort of manga and sensationalist style of writing, and you just don't like stuff like fan service at all, don't read it, because you won't like it and you'll probably complain about it on Twitter. So do yourself a favor and read it if it's the sort of thing that suits you. If it doesn't suit you, then don't read it, because I just know you won't like it. And that is most of the podcast. So let's jump to some closing thoughts on Heroes Rising. We've strayed very far from Heroes Rising, and by reading Redo of Healer, I think I've strayed very far from my values, but we're on the road to recovery here. So here are some closing thoughts on Heroes Rising. So I'm going to keep this one short, because I've spoken about what I think of Heroes Rising so many times within this podcast alone, and have summarized it as well. So what do I think of Heroes Rising? I think this film is decent. There are most definitely some very good parts to this film, and its production values and its character management and things like that are very good, and those are also fundamentals of My Hero Academia, and I cannot take that away from it. The component of the antagonist simply does not meet my expectations, or didn't meet my expectations mostly because I feel like the antagonist was not much of a roadblock in regards of thinking and ideology, and instead this ideology just felt attached on. I don't feel like it's my place to give recommendations for non-canon film that's kind of just... Anyone that likes My Hero Academia will most likely like this film and won't see what I'm talking about, and that is perfectly fine, and I can understand where you're coming from. As a simple film, as an entity of media, if you want to call it that, I think it just lacks in some crucial areas, which is why I couldn't like it to the extent of which I wanted to. Thank you for listening to this episode of Gas in the Mecha. That has been episode 38. Maybe I'm viewing it unfairly. If I am, send me your criticism or send me your critique, whether that's a tweet, whether that's an email. How do you email me? That is guestinthemecha@gmail.com. You can email me there. Your questions on the podcast, what you thought of the episode, what you think of the quality of the podcast, any of those things. Feel free to email me. Tell me what you think and I might even read it out myself, and that would be some good discourse to have on a podcast like this. You can also tweet me @GetInTheMecha. So if you want to send a message on how you feel about 9, or how do you feel about the show? What do you think about my criticism? Was it unfair? Was it very fair? Do you agree? Do you not agree? Feel free to send that as well via Twitter or email. Thank you to Feedspot.com, as I said earlier in the episode, for putting us up for one of the top 30 manga podcasts on the web. That's really appreciated. Thank you guys for listening. Hopefully you are all staying safe at home, and if you have to go to work, I hope you are also staying safe as well. You are saving lives, and so we really do appreciate you, and I appreciate you. Keep washing your hands, guys. I have been your host, Jamal, today, and this has been Get in the Mecha. The music in this production goes as follows: Go Lucky by Chasers Gaming, Mandatory Overtime by Joth, Difference by Chasers Gaming, and 8-Bit Title Screen by Joth.